Oak session number 12204, reel 3.
Is there an injury of three?
Yeah. Up near the Uganda border, or Mombasa down on the coast, we're actually less sort of involved and knew less about Mau Mau than people in England, because the local newspapers didn't spread it so dramatically as papers like the Daily Mirror did in England. So they would see nothing of Mau Mau. They'd hear about it. The local papers would print the odd stories about what had happened, various murders and things like that, but that was all they would know about. It was by the local radio news and the newspapers. They wouldn't see anything.
Did you ever speak to any of the people in your charge, any of the Mau Mau people in your charge about it?
Yes, I did. At Waitheka Works Camps, which was in Kiambu district, I had six what we call prominent prisoners. And the leading one was Peter Muigai Kenyatta, who was Jomo Kenyatta's eldest son. And so Jomo had two sons called Peter Muigai, who was his first son by his first Kikuyu wife, and he had a one by the white woman he married when he was a milkman in London, had a son Peter by her, who was the last of his children at that time. After his release from Lokitong, he married a young Popsi Mama Ngina and had some children by her. But Peter Muigai was his eldest son. And he hadn't really done a lot wrong. He was basically detained because he was Jomo Kenyatta's son. But there were the another five with them who were all related to prominent Mau Mau leaders. And one of them had tried to poison a home guard unit who were loyalist Kikuyus, tried to put poison in the tea urn. And so he'd been more or less detained because of that, I think. He was quite a bright chap. I can't remember his name. I can't remember any of them except Peter. But I used to go and talk to them sometimes in the evenings. They had a hut all to themselves. They weren't put with the regular prisoners. And they used to sometimes go in the evening. I was a single man then, we hadn't married, and spend a couple of hours then talking to them. Didn't get an awful lot out of them. Either they weren't saying, or they didn't know. The sort of motivation I was looking for just wasn't in their thinking at all. And Peter always used to say he had nothing to do with it, didn't approve of it at all. He was only detained because he was his father's son, so he didn't particularly approve of his father.
Can you remember anything else that passed in the conversation with these VIPs?
They didn't say an awful lot, actually. As I say, if they had any deep ideas, they'd really keep themselves to themselves a lot. The only one I remember ever being particularly violent in speech was a bloke down at Mara River Camp, who was very much a pro-Mau Mau bloke, and I remember him shouting at me one day for the education of other prisoners who were listening and watching eagerly for this confrontation, telling me that the white men were keeping the blacks poor, were deliberately depriving them of money, and they weren't allowed to have anything, weren't allowed to have radios. And I pointed out, said, "Well, you're talking nonsense. The water staff have all got radios." And he insisted, no, they hadn't. They weren't allowed to have radios because they were black. He said, "Well, come with me and have a look and see. You'll see for yourself." But he wouldn't. He was just absolute propaganda nonsense. And they'd spread stories like saying the Russians had sent a battleship to Mombasa to help out Mau Mau, and they were going to come ashore and help Mau Mau win the battle, and all this all sorts of nonsensical stories there. When Mau Mau had won, there would be two trains and they would meet at Nairobi, and one would be bringing all the Kikuyu prisoners back home, and the other would be taking all the Kikuyu loyalists down to prison camps. And they were really looking forward to this day. They really thought it was going to happen. And some of them spread the story that no prisoners sentenced to death were really killed. They went through the motions. They pretended they'd been killed, but in fact they'd been taken away to a big secret government farm and were all working there and would be released and brought home again after Mau Mau victory. That was the sort of stories the propagandists would spread round among the prisoners. The sort of thing they had to be disabused of before they could be eventually released.
How did you disabuse them of it?
Oh, well, the rehabilitation staff used to do this by talking to them and what have you.
Do you think they really believed these stories?
Well, some of them were very gullible, yeah. And a lot of them at that stage would believe anything a black man told them against an obvious truth told by a white man, because they believed all this propaganda that the white man was deliberately keeping them down and stopping them being rich and having good jobs.
What was the attitude of people like Maasai and other tribes towards Mau Mau?
Weren't involved. In fact, they would have happily gone in with their spears and killed any Kikuyu in sight if we'd let them. They were very disappointed the government wouldn't allow them to set about the Kikuyu.
What made you think that was their attitude?
Well, they asked the government, could they attack the Kikuyu? And the government said, no, you couldn't, you can't. There was one famous incident at a showground. My wife would remember this. And it was after we were married. It was mostly a Kikuyu gathering, and a small group of Maasai turned up. And Maasai always carried the spears. And on this occasion, they'd hidden them in the bush before they went into the showground, sort of like a farm show with cattle and all this sort of thing around there. And a group of Kikuyu saw them and started barracking them and throwing stones at them and what have you, and threatening them. And the Maasai turned round to go for their spears, and the Kikuyu thought they'd got them on the run, and they jubilantly chased this little group of Mau Mau up the valley until the Mau Mau got their spears, when the whole procession turned round and this small group of Maasai chased all the Kikuyu back down to the fairground and killed one or two or three of them on the way. So they were quite happy to set about Kikuyu any time.
When did that incident occur?
Well, we hadn't been married all that long. It must have been about 1960, I would think. I think I married my wife about 1958, so it could have been any time there, 59, 60-ish.
And where did
she
it occur?
She would remember it, just at Nairobi. We had a big showground there where they used to have these fairs and things, and there was a race course there.
You were telling me earlier about what you gathered at second hand about what happened in the incident at Hola Camp.
Mm.
Can you tell me what you understood was the cause?
Well, I knew Spike Sullivan from when I very first got to Kenya. He was at Kamiti Prison. He was on the staff there, Spike. And he, as I say, was an ex-naval chap and quite a character in his own way. And somehow or other he got selected to take over this camp. The 2IC of prisons, who'd been a district commissioner and had come in his retirement, I suppose, to the prison department, and wasn't suited because he wasn't a prison officer at all, and he wasn't at all popular. My wife would remember his name, Beth and I do. No, I can't remember. She would. She will. He apparently picked Spike Sullivan to go to Hola and take over as commandant. And so he had a pretty bad bunch there, and they wouldn't work. That was the crux of the whole thing. Part of their Mau Mau oath was that they wouldn't cooperate, and they just wouldn't work. So somebody devised the bright idea of taking them out and physically making them work. A couple of warders would grab hold of them and put a spade in their hands and then bend them through the motions of shoveling up some dirt. And the idea being that once they'd actually done that, they'd committed an act of work, and that broke the oath, and they were free of it. I don't know whether it worked or not, but that was the idea. Now, Spike, instead of taking out small groups to do that under water escort, turned the whole camp out in this long column, with himself at one end where he couldn't control anything, in a Land Rover. And when the trouble started, of course, he couldn't get back. There were groups of Kikuyu rioting and messing around all over the place, and The warders just got purely out of control, drew their little batons and set about the prisoners, and they killed them. They beat some of them. I don't know how many were killed now, I can't remember. But everyone was killed, was beaten to death by the African warders. And the few white officers there were actually physically pulling them off, the convicts, and throwing them away, sort of thing, or detainees, whatever they were. I can't remember that, who were in Hola then. But that's what happens. It was misjudgment by Spike in turning the whole camp out in one go instead of taking out small groups.
Are there any other memories that you've got of your service in Kenya that we could record?
In the prisons, not afterwards in customs, because that wasn't in the Mau Mau area, in the prisons.
Yeah, during the
Mau Mau. I was on the Mwea Plains for a matter of a few weeks, and we started a rice scheme there, and they had about four camps up there for the prisoners who were going to grow rice on the Mwea Plains, but it didn't come to anything.
What was this rice scheme?
To grow rice as a food crop for the Kikuyu on the Mwea Plains, and were pretty damp. No, it was going to be a local product for the local people. The same way as they tried to start a pig industry among the Kikuyu. But the Kikuyu didn't take to them. They didn't take to rice because it was quite foreign to them. And they were never successful with pigs either. In fact, we never did manage to do much with them. They always used to look at European cattle, which were big, beefy, particularly the bulls. You know what a big prime bull looks like. An African bull looked like a whippet compared to them. And they would always goggle and wonder and say, how is it done? I think this was something special to Europeans, and it couldn't be done by them. And the reason was, of course, that they counted their wealth in cattle by numbers, not in quality. So they would overgraze their fields. They put seven animals in a space where only one could survive properly, because it was numbers that were all important, and it didn't matter how poor they were. As long as it was seven cows, that was wealth. Much more than one cow in tip-top condition. They were a bit, very much like that. So we never did manage to get very far on that with them. We tried education all the time. When I was at Embakasi prison, and there was nothing much to do in the evenings, and I used to run classes there for those that had a smattering of English. I used to run classes in the evening in general things, English, arithmetic, because although I wasn't a highly educated fellow, I knew a damn sight more than they did, sort of thing, so I could teach them English and arithmetic and all this sort of thing. And by their standards, I was highly educated, and they placed great value on education, particularly being able to read and write in English, which is a key to all sorts of jobs which they couldn't otherwise get.
Did you ever meet Kenyatta?
No, I didn't meet him personally. I saw him several times, but as I say, I knew his eldest son Peter. I knew his daughter Margaret, who used to come to the camp to visit Peter. She subsequently became mayor of Nairobi, Margaret Kenyatta. It was a job they grabbed. I mean, in colonial days, the mayor was like an English mayor; it was an annual office. But after independence, when Margaret grabbed it, she made it an office for life. So she was mayor of Nairobi for life, I think. Typical, that was. She was a much more vicious personality than Peter. Peter was an amiable, pleasant chap.
How was she?
But she was she didn't like white people at all. Very anti-white she was.
Did she say to you to give that
impression? Always used to, the looks she used to give you, other things. And she would hardly speak. She embarrassed poor Peter at times when he was with me, and say to Margaret, you remember Mr. Image? And she gave me a very dirty look and said, yes, I remember him. From the when she used to come out to the camp to see Peter. This incident happened after they were released when I met them. He subsequently opened up a nightclub in Nairobi, Peter with a partner, and he died some years ago. I read in the local paper that Peter had died.
Was she his proper sister or a half-sister?
She may have had a different mother. They would have all been Jomos, but because Kikuyu went in for plural marriages, you know, whether they share the same mother or not, I wouldn't know. But that wouldn't make any difference to them. they still see themselves as full brother and sister, as they had them one father. I don't know how they felt towards the white boy, Peter, or the half-white boy. He went out to Kenya after his father had become Prime Minister for his inauguration, but I don't think he stayed.
Did you like being in Kenya?
Oh yes, loved it. Especially the first year or two. My first year running at Karicho prison, I think, was one of the happiest I've ever known. It was really pleasant. And we were very happy there until, after independence, by the time about 68 or so, it was obvious that things were going more and more downhill. Robberies were increasing, violent robberies. The police took to carrying rifles in Nairobi. There were certain shortages. I was doing a lot of flying, but by that time I was a high-ranking customs officer. I used to fly off to border conferences in the Sudan, Ethiopia, round and about like that, the Northern Frontier District. And the government had started what they called a crash training program, and we used to remark very bitterly that it really was crash training, because the rate of crashes among Kenya Air Force planes went up tremendously. And we used to use the Kenya police as our sort of local air transport. I was great friends with the Assistant Commissioner of Police that ran the Kenya Police Air Wing and did their programming. And if we wanted to go anywhere for a conference, we'd just ring him up and say, look, we want to get up to this conference, so-and-so. And he might well have been going in the same direction himself anyway, and he would arrange a plane for us, and we'd go off with the Kenya police pilot. I remember old Punch Bearcroft was in charge of the actual flying of the wing. He had one hand, had his left hand missing, and he used to fly by shoving this through the stirrup on the control column. That he, the first time I met him, he flew me down from Nyeri in about 1956, and I'd been in hospital there, and he flew me down to Nairobi for hospital treatment in Nairobi. It wasn't available in Kisumu, and it wasn't until we landed and I turned around to shake hands with him and I realised he only had the one hand, because I was sitting behind him in this small Cessna Piper or something of that sort. He was in the pilot seat and I was behind in the passenger seat, and I didn't realise at all that he had one hand missing. Later I got to know him, and I was flying about in customs, he would often be our pilot.
You were telling me earlier that there was some fear that a new movement to replace Mau Mau might come about whilst you were there.
Yes. Be about 57, 58-ish. 58, yeah, must have been, because in 59 I went into Kenya Customs, so it was before that. It would have been probably about 58. There was a society set up called Kiama Kiamawingi, which was supposed to be Kikuyu for Men of the Trees, it was called, which suggested, of course, they would go back in the bush like Mau Mau did. And we had warnings come round to watch out for this, and that there were stories that oathing was going on in one or two of the provinces and districts, and we all had to draw up security orders for our camps in the event of insurrection. And at that time, of course, we were still very much defensive camps. We had high wire fences with dannet wire rolls at the foot and the top, and a large ditch dug all the way around the camp, a really deep ditch lined with punjis, which were sharpened bamboo stakes fixed in the sides and the bottom, so anybody fell in would be skewered through and through with these bamboo stakes. But it never did come to anything. There were a few people who were detained and brought into the camps, but they were released almost immediately, within days or a week at the most. I think it was realised it was all a fiasco, there was nothing to it, and they let them out again.
Did you see any of them?
Yes, we had some of them in there. Didn't have a lot to do with them. Our job was just to hold them, keep them in secure conditions, look after them and hold them until the order came down to let them go. And by that time, Mau Mau was very much a thing of the past. We were busily processing people for release as fast as we could. At weekends, they used to have virtually an open day when they would allow the families to visit the prisoners, of all men from the local district. and they would come in with them and sort of bring them food, and they'd picnic in the grass and sit and chat and what have you. It was to sort of ease them back into tribal life and show them the desirability of being free and home with their families rather than sitting behind barbed wire in a detention camp because they were still being stubborn about confessing all their mammal activities.